Relationship Psych, the podcast, helping you design the relationship you want. With couples therapy costing a pretty penny, Relationship Psych gives you access to couples therapy insights without spending a dime. Tune in for discussions on communication, managing conflict, recovering from infidelity, attachment, and more. I'm your host, Amber Dawson. I'm a psychologist and couples therapist. A few of my favorite things are my husband, grapes, and my adorable little dog, Riggs. Simply by listening, you're going to get tools to help you and your partner create a loving and harmonious relationship that can withstand the test of time. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be misconstrued for specific relationship advice. For advice for your specific relationship, seek out a local couples therapist in your area. Welcome back to Relationship Psych, the podcast. I have a very exciting guest with us today because they're going to talk about a topic that can be one of the hardest topics to talk about with someone you love. So I'm going to introduce them and then we'll dive into it. So I have Dr. Glenn and Phyllis Hill, who spent the first 30 years of their marriage living in disconnect, which sucks. No one wants to live in disconnect. Love. Their first sexual experience sent them into years of avoidance and pain. And Dr. Glenn was so determined to find out what was wrong. He went back to school, became a marriage and family therapist and a clinical sexologist, which a lot of us don't have the time or finances or will to do. So super excited to talk to you and get the Cliff Notes version of what on earth was going on. It wasn't until they dug deep into their emotional connection where he discovered the source of their disconnect. From there, they discovered the connection codes, which is a framework to help couples connect emotionally and physically using their 4-minute tool. Now, their authors, speakers, have connection codes in over 50 countries and are living in peace in their relationship. And isn't that what so many of us want? To be in peace with the partner we chose?
Yeah.
So welcome to the show. So excited to have you, hear you share your story and learn about these connection codes. So welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Amber.
So exciting to be with you and love your audience. We've had a chance to listen to your podcast. And so it's really fun for us to get to actually meet you and now to be guests on your podcast. So that's really great.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you for asking me to be here. Glad to have you. So I'd love to hear a little bit about where you started off, because living in disconnection, the first sexual experience leading you to pain and avoidance, like that, I think is relatable. Yeah. For so many couples with good intentions who care about each other, but something goes wrong and it's hard to figure out what or how to get back there. So would you mind sharing whatever feels authentic where your beginning is, that disconnection or some of that pain avoidance, what happened there?
Well, you know, for us, we met, we were high school sweethearts. We had a long distance relationship a good bit of the time. We didn't live in the same city. And you know, the closer or further down the road in our relationship we got, we were like, yeah, we want to spend the rest of our lives together. And yet we had those, you know, the list of things that we felt were really important. We wanted to have good jobs. And so we wanted the financial security there. We actually were able to buy our first house before the wedding. And the things that we thought this is really the maturity of that and just the stability of that. Yeah. Really thought, okay, we've got a good community around us. We've got the support of that, you know, even with our wedding, like we planned that dream wedding. Glenn actually wrote several songs that he sang to me in the wedding. And so, you know, it was like all the things that you dream of and you think, okay, now we are set up to have that perfect marriage. And, you know, back in those days, I would say even now, you know, looking at what we did to emotionally prepare us for the wedding, yeah, there was none of that. And there was no speak of that. No one spoke of that. No one even talked to us about, hey, here's some of the challenges of marriage. Nobody did that. And so we just made up kind of our own list. And that's, you know, all the things that we valued and we had those on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for us, it was like going even into the honeymoon. And Glenn had planned, you know, the most romantic everything about it type honeymoon. But I think that for us, it was the not knowing that really knocked us off course, like right away. And there's, you know, there's a big difference. We didn't live together before we were married. And we had actually had decided that we would not have sexual intercourse before we were married. And, you know, we did a lot of making out and we loved that side of it, but we had saved this one thing, thinking that because we had saved it, it would just make everything perfect. Like, I think we really went into our marriage thinking we've done all the right things. And so really quickly, for me especially, it kind of started with me that went into like just trauma for me right away on our honeymoon, because it was like the one thing that we had saved became the focus. And then we kind of left everything else off. And so for me, it was like, well, that was not a fun encounter. That was not at all what I was expecting. And why in the heck did we even save that to this point in our lives?
Yeah. Which was the greatest 11 seconds of my life at that point. So I didn't understand her lack of gratitude. It was shocking to me, and it was shocking for both of us. And so we ended up we went to a honeymoon resort. And so we spent most of our honeymoon water skiing, which I didn't know I'd married a water skiaholic. But she figured out if we were on a boat with other people, none of that sex stuff was going to happen. So
you could marry all the other people on the boat. Yeah.
but I mean, that just started a pattern for us that literally was about two decades before we began to recover from that. And we had no idea. Again, we thought we were set up for success. We were faith-based then and on the early beginnings of the purity culture. And we thought, oh, okay, we did all the right things. And so we thought that we were going to be set up for happily ever after. And that was our plan. And 48 hours after our wedding, we were like, oh my gosh, what just happened? And what do we do now? And we had no idea. We had no tools to be able to process through what had happened for us.
Well, what strikes me is just how relatable that story is. Like, so many people, I think, go into the wedding. At least maybe the relationship's gone well enough to that point where they want to get married and they plan this beautiful wedding. And that's where TV and Disney stops. At the wedding, right?
Yeah.
You don't hear what happens after that. You don't hear about the struggles. Like, that's not going to make a blockbuster for Hollywood, after the wedding. That's the end. Ta-da, we're done. And so you got to that point. You achieved that thing. Because I don't think people really talk about what happens after. I mean, we're starting to, us here today, we're having some of that conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's jarring for so many couples who love each other, who chose to be together, that then the climax of the story, but there's so much of the story left. We got, all these other books left to write, but how do you write them? We don't know.
Yeah.
And that, for us, it's like the everyday life became about logistics, where if it was almost like we fought about things and it was a matter of, okay, are we, there was always a right and a wrong kind of thing. And so it was determining who's right in this and who's wrong in this. And I learned really quickly that I'm going to come up short on this one every time. And so, Glenn's ways were the right and mine were not. And, at that point in my life, I was like, okay, I'm willing to consider that. Okay. He does have the right way to fold towels and I'm just off on that one. Or, he has the right way to organize the dishes and I just miss on that. But it became this exhausting lifestyle of discussion over all the logistics in running a house. And, and then of course, down the road, when we started our family, then it became even more complicated in just how we would fight over logistics. And, one of the things, a big turning point, sadly, it was probably after 20 years of marriage, where we call it our dishwasher story. Glenn had unloaded the dishwasher and I came into the kitchen and I was starting to, whatever dinner, and I was going to load something. And that's when I realized, oh, he's unloaded it. And I said, thanks, babe, for unloading the dishwasher, which I had said many times before. And in my mind, that is a proper thing to say. Thank you for unloading the dishwasher. And the other person is supposed to say, you're welcome. But not in our marriage. Glenn never would say, you're welcome. And so his comeback to me often led to a fight. And that particular day, I kind of had a choice. I could either just ignore him. I could leave the room. I could give, something back to him, kind of in the level of what he gave me. Or I could get curious and I could actually say, babe, what do you hear me say?
Yeah. Because what we did not grasp is that I happen to live with one of the most productive people on the planet. She's perpetual motion. She gets more done in 10 minutes than I do in a day. And she happens to live with one of the people that are less productive. I'm fun to have around, but I struggle getting things done. So when she would say, thanks for unloading the dishwasher, which sounds so incredibly good and right, I would respond with something like, well, it's not like that's the only thing I've done today, or it's not like it's the first time I've ever unloaded the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. To which this poor girl would be like, wait, what? I didn't say anything about that. I just said, thanks for unloading the dishwasher. And I would say, well, I don't understand why you have to make such a big deal about it, you know, because what I experienced was her making fun of me, that she's trying to humiliate me, that, well, you don't get crap done. You know, it's a miracle. Glenn did something useful for a change. Call the internet, you know, let's get some confetti and have a party, which had nothing to do with what Phyllis was saying. But that's what I was experiencing. And again, we did not do this once, twice, 10 times, probably 1,000 woundings from interaction like that. And when she slowed down and found out what was happening for me, it was revolutionary for us and changed at least the trajectory of our relationship when she found out all the stuff that was happening for her partner that she just didn't know. And again, none of that had to do with Phyllis. That was all a matter of what was happening inside of Glenn.
What you just highlighted there is so powerful, profound, so important. I just want to highlight that you two were experiencing the same situation.
Yeah.
Phyllis saying thanks for unloading the dishwasher. Yeah. How you interpreted the facts of that situation were radically different from your own point of views.
Yeah.
And that happens about big things and it happens about small things. And when small things become big things, we know that there's something going on beneath the surface. That's one of the hardest things I find to explain to clients is what this means to you can be very different. And right now you just did a beautiful job illustrating that the meaning that that comment had meant entirely different things to you based on how you were interpreting the context of it, your prior feelings, how you both show up in the family and what your roles were. And of course, when you perceive like she's humiliating you, of course, you're going to say something like, I've done other things, or this is the only other thing I did today. If you're feeling attacked, if that's what's going on for you, like that makes sense. And of course, Phyllis, if you're truly meaning to give a compliment and say thank you, you're like probably a bit taken aback, jarred, like very confused.
Yeah. But again, only about 1,000 times.
Yeah.
So we had had all these woundings, all these paper cuts, and had zero idea, just did not know that this was what was happening between us. And it's so important to emphasize that Phyllis was not wrong. She was not bad that she was saying thank you. But I would also suggest Glenn is not wrong or bad that he's experiencing what he's experiencing. He's not trying to experience that. He just is. And now we have the tools to actually process that through. And so interactions like that, which this stuns me to even say it, but we experience it now. We literally process through things like that in 20 to 30 seconds, whereas that used to be a 3-day to 3-week conflict. And that's a lot of life difference between 30 seconds and 3 days. Which mesmerizes us. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So this conversation was a catalyst. Phyllis gets curious. She asks you what's going on. And then what changes happen from there?
Well, you know, when I asked, what do you hear me say? Like, what is happening for you? And he shared it.
Let me just say first, I interjected, which is horrible. I'm not defending this, but I said, I hear you say what you said. And I didn't say the B word, but I thought it. And again, if she had, you know, flipped me a finger and walked out of the room, she would have been justified in doing that. And instead, she stayed in it, which is remarkable that she had the guts to do and just the gratuitous kindness to do that. And she said, yeah, but what do you hear? What's the message? And just so you know, Amber, I'm the educated one. Phyllis is the smart one. She's the one that figures out things that actually matter. And in that moment, she was outrageously intelligent and courageous enough to stay with me and find out what happened for me. And once she found out, she's like, oh, well, no wonder you respond the way you respond. I've just insulted you profusely. Mm-hmm. Of course, you're not going to say you're welcome. You know, somebody gives you an incredible, you know, insult and, you know, humiliates you and you go, you're welcome. That doesn't make any sense. So she had no idea that that's what was happening. Me. I interrupted. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. So, you know, the curiosity and then the way he responded and shared with me what was happening for him, it made so much sense in our patterns. Mm. And I, you know, it's kind of like, okay, so many words that come out of my mouth, you don't hear them with the intention that I'm saying them. And, you know, I found that we often kind of our marriage was like when we had conflicts, it was like going into the courtroom to prove who's right and who's wrong. And, you know, we would feel like we had to show up with the evidence of the situation. And then, you know, so often it would be a matter of getting, you know, before a judge and a jury. And I, you know, I remember so often saying, I wish we had video cameras in the house and we could replay what just happened, because I never said that that way. And that was a lot of our conversations, which of course, that's not reality. You don't have cameras in your house and you play back every conflict, every conversation, you know.
And if you do start recording everything, it's not helpful.
No, it's not. It's not right. Because again, what was happening in his head, what was happening for him, would not show up on a camera. And, you know, I, in those moments, I realized I'm missing it with him because I don't understand what's happening for him. And one, when that happened and he responded to me, we didn't spiral into a conflict. It was like, wow, hearing what's happening for you allows us to stay connected. And then, you know, of course, then the next time it worked again. And whenever he would respond to me in a way that didn't make sense to me, those were the moments that I would say to him, babe, what's happening for you? And it got him to slow down so that he could tune into himself. And then he could say to me what he was experiencing. And so often I would just be like, wow. As in, just couldn't believe it, because that was not at all what I was experiencing.
Yeah. And this is years before we developed the tools that we have now, but just slowing down was huge for us, for her to slow down enough to consider that I was experiencing something. And just for the record, you know, it was incumbent on me to tell her what was happening, and I did not. I did not know how. I didn't have the tools. And I mostly was unaware for myself what was happening. So I certainly couldn't convey it in a manageable way to her. And that's what, you know, fast forwarding many years, what catapulted us to develop the tools that we now have so that we know how to do that again in 20 to 30 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to get to that pretty quick. I'm curious though, how do you think this notion of like going into conflicts, trying to figure out who's right, who's wrong, the judge, the jury are out, misunderstanding each other, how do you think that led or contributed to the dissatisfaction in your sexual relationship?
Great question.
Yeah, that is a good question. Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, sex is a really vulnerable place to be with another person. And if you're fighting over logistics during the day, it's super hard to feel safe in that. And, you know, I think that for me, especially just because we know for women, it takes us a minute to get there. And so much of it is that being able to feel, to let go, to feel free, to actually tune into your own body, to realize, wow, I'm able to get there. I'm able to have the sexual pleasure you're having. You just get there so much faster, but it's an emotional thing. Like it's, if I am feeling hurt from a conversation we had earlier, or, you know, had that courtroom experience earlier, I'm still feeling that later in the day when he's trying to connect with me sexually. And he may physically be able to get there. He's turned on, he's able to, you know, have that orgasm. And then for me, it was, I was so wounded that I was like, sure, I'll just show up for you, but I'm not showing up for me. And that's where this whole side really played out. And that's where we saw that no matter how, you know, many techniques we have or how much freedom we have in our sexual relationship, if we're disconnected emotionally, I'm not showing up.
Yeah. And what the research shows just somatically, we now know this, is no longer a theory or just an idea, but the brain doesn't distinguish physical from emotional pain. So the equivalent of that is that, you know, Amber, I see you in person and I stab a screwdriver into your shoulder and then I go, hey, you want to go get a cup of coffee? And you have a screwdriver or a hole in your shoulder. And I'm like, what? I took the screwdriver out. It's not there anymore, Amber. You know, let's go have a cup of coffee. You would not be able to connect with me because I wounded you. You are bleeding. And that's exactly what's happening relationally. Then you take it into the sexual realm. So I just stabbed this woman. I just wounded her. I harmed her. And then for me to say to her, hey, you want to have some fun sex time? She's bleeding. She's so overwhelmed. She's wounded. And and it's not that she couldn't, but I would argue that she shouldn't because she does not feel safe with me. And I've wounded her. And until we deal with that wound, it's very, very difficult to expose yourself, whether literally or figuratively. And again, those sort of interactions are happening all the time. Males typically are much more readily and more frequently and more easily activated sexually. And so they go through this incredible wounding time. Well, 10, 15 minutes later, he's fine. He's like, oh, okay, well, let's do some sex stuff. And she is still very, very much wounded and even traumatized by what they experienced 20 minutes ago. Sorry. Which would include 20 years ago, but she is unable to, you know, to be vulnerable. And I think sex is one of the most vulnerable things that we do. And it makes it very, very difficult.
Totally. So you've kind of jumped from, you know, what happened to some of the research, which I think is a great place to go. So you talked about some of the pain and you said our brain doesn't know the difference. Summarizing, might have this wrong, so correct me if it's wrong, between true, like physical pain and emotional pain, those are going to land the same. Yeah. And when you were talking about me being stabbed in the shoulder with your screwdriver, I was contorting my face for those of you who realize you listen. Yeah. See, I'm thinking, I'm not going for coffee with this guy. Absolutely not. Yeah. Like, that's what I'm thinking. So I can only imagine, you know, sexual experience. You feel like you're stabbed and bleeding and you're thinking, absolutely not. No way. Right. So
exactly.
In what other ways do emotions connect to the role of sex?
You ask these deep, difficult questions, Amber. My gosh.
That's our job. Ask hard questions.
That's great.
You guys are so good at answering them. Like, there's anyone asking you to.
Well, okay. So let's deep dive into emotion. And that's a big part of our story, even, you know, so I want to give a little bit of backstory on that, is that I very much was raised in a family where tasks were what was acceptable. Emotions were not. And, you know, I was the youngest of eight. We sat at the dinner table, silence was expected. And so I kind of grew up with I don't tune into my own emotions. I don't tune into needs. Matter of fact, I don't do emotions. And when I met Glenn, he was the life of the party. And I thought, okay, he has enough emotions for both of us. I don't need emotions. I don't do emotions. And of course that's not true. But I didn't know that your brain houses emotions. I didn't know that they fire in your brain and that we all have them. We all have the same ones. And it was, you know, I was 50 before I learned all this. And it was through Glenn's research and all of his schooling, just that got us to realize, wow, emotions is what's behind everything. And it's affecting us in such a big way. And so even sexually, like to not have the language to be able to even tune in to sexual joy, to sexual loneliness, to just being able to show up in that space and being able to authentically talk about what you're experiencing. I think, you know, Hollywood is our teacher on so many things. And in Hollywood movies, you know, you see a guy and a girl hook up in a bar and, you know, their first sexual encounter is mind blowing and she's obviously orgasming, you know, having an orgasm because of the noises that she's making. And it's like, that's what we expect in real life. And then we find out, oh, that's not how it works in real life. And, you know, it's like totally missing that because of our teachers. Right. And so then you go, okay, what about emotion? Like, how in the world do we, in our sexual encounters, be able to show up and talk about our needs? And to be able to, because so often without the right language, it's like we say things that the other person can interpret as wounding or like an insult. And then it shuts down such an intimate situation. And we hear stories with clients all the time about a memory they have that is still affecting them to this day. And the memory was from 10 years ago. Yeah. And it's like, wow, that still affects you sexually. And it's like, yeah, because it's unprocessed emotion. It's not a topic that you emotionally are talking about with the person that that you are being intimate with.
Yeah. And if once we get that, that the brain doesn't distinguish physical pain from emotional pain. So if, you know, whatever, the wife and husband are in a room and the room catches on fire. And so now the drapes are burning. And I mean, there's just flames everywhere. To think that either one of them is going to feel safe, to feel relaxed enough to have great sexual connection. Well, that doesn't make any sense. No one would be able to do that. The house is on fire. It's burning down around you. Maybe you're even getting burned by the flames. So let's go ahead and have a great sexual encounter. That's not a thing. No one is able to do that. Well, the exact parallel is happening for people. They're wounded. They're mm-hmm. bleeding. They're burning from the flames of their conflict. And then, and I think it's more challenging typically for women than men in this. But even for men, if he feels wounded by that, that's the reason that the erectile dysfunction industry now is a $1 billion industry. Because men can't even get an erection because they experience so much unprocessed emotion in this setting. And we're, again, the tools we developed is to help people know how to do that, to process the emotion, to get the flames put out. Because as long as that fire is raging, you're going to have a tough time, very, very difficult time connecting in any way, much less sexually.
Yeah, I'm like imagining laying on my bed with my curtains burning down. I'm thinking, even if the fire is not touching me, I'm choking on smoke.
Yep.
I can't breathe. That's not going to be a very enjoyable sexual experience.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Right. So
with all that unprocessed emotion that can get in the way, we're experiencing it as pain. It's not, doesn't matter if it's emotional, physical, doesn't matter if it happened 2 minutes ago, right. 20 minutes ago, or in some cases, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. If it's unprocessed, it's getting in the way of our ability to be present, safe, and enjoy that experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. So if someone's listening to this and maybe they're relating to like emotion, I don't do that. It's for my partner, or even better, neither of us does it. Or like, it's for those other people that are like woke or something. But if they're like a little interested because they want a better sex life, how would somebody begin to identify an emotion if that feels new or unfamiliar to them?
Yeah, and that was what was the beginning of the research that I was able to. And let me just say quickly that I'm the educated one. Phyllis is the smart one. She's the one that figured everything out.
And you already said that. And I love it that you've said it again.
It's still true.
Yeah, that's good.
In the 2000s, she said, babe, as hard as you, I was a contractor and not a very good one. She said, as hard as you work, we should be rich and we're not rich. So you got to do something different. And she made me quit working, which I don't know a lot of men who can say my wife made me quit working. And she said, I'll take care of money. I'll provide. You go back to school, finish your degrees, and figure this thing out. And we didn't know what that meant. We just meant we're going to do something different. And so I did. And I finished up my undergrad, got my master's, and she said, keep going. And then got my doctorate. And that allowed me the time and the setting and the lack of pressure because I didn't have to generate revenue. And that allowed me to just devote myself to research and again, at first I'm basically sitting down with a blank sheet of paper. I don't have any idea. I'd gone through so much schooling and still didn't really find the answers. I mean, there were some helpful things in there, but I thought I still don't know what causes 24 hours before the wedding to 24 hours after the wedding. Doesn't make sense. How can that possibly be? And then I began, spent 2.5 years just observing interactions and notating what happens where this person moves away from that person, either geographically or relationally. And that's what eventually led us to, and again, I've just researched the research a lot too, to go, what are people discovering out there that disconnects people, or conversely, what connects them? And it all got back to emotions, that humans actually connect through shared emotions, through processed emotion, and people disconnect, or at least don't connect and frequently disconnect from unprocessed emotion. So if I feel wounded by Phyllis, I'm going to disconnect from her. I'm going to, again, either geographically or relationally, I'm going to move away from her. And forget the sex part. This is just basic interaction. We're not going to have safe interaction. So when we discovered that and realized that it's all about emotion, it is not about logistics. And we basically said for centuries, as far as our culture, that, oh, it's all about logistics. If you work out the logistics, and I'm not against these things, but even, you know, dating apps, you know, you have to match up logistically. Well, Phyllis and I are as different today as we've ever been. We haven't cloned each other. We experience things very, very differently, but we know how to dance because we know how to process emotion. And in doing that, that is the connection. It's not the logistical part.
I think, you know, you, as far as the question and just your listeners, and this is part of even more so my story, Glenn's doing the research and I am just living life. And I'm at this point, I've built a company, I'm, you know, working all the time, taking care of our family financially. And I began, my body began reacting negatively. And I think when your body starts shutting down, it gets your attention. Yeah. And so for me, I was successful in business, but my body wasn't cooperating. And, you know, what was happening during that time is in the first quarter of that year, my mom was dying of cancer. Mm-hmm. And my business quadrupled in size. And wow. So the pressure of those two things sent me over the edge for the first time in my life, where I just could no longer hold up everything that I'd been holding up. And so at this time, Glenn's doing the research that he's doing, and he suggests to me that emotion has a lot to do with what I'm going through. And I just thought that was ridiculous. And
she said the thing she always says, she goes, No, I don't do emotion.
You
have plenty of emotion for both of us. I don't right. do emotion.
And, you know, even just addressing like the sadness that I was going through with my mother dying, mm-hmm. I would say to him, I don't have time to be sad. Yeah. And I believed that made sense. Like that you could set that on the back burner and just wait mm-hmm. for another whatever years later to actually process that sadness. Well, my body was saying, no way, you're not going to put this off. And then the pressure of work and the stress of work, I didn't even know what to do with that. Because, you know, when you own a company and it's growing like crazy, that's incredible. That's everybody's dream. That kind of success is everybody's dream. Well, so I was so confused as to why my body wasn't cooperating. And then Glenn is, he's talking to me about emotion. I'm like, no, I don't do emotion. And I am the successful one because I'm task oriented and you're an emotional wreck most of the time. And so it just didn't make any sense to me, but I was desperate because my body was not functioning. And so when he started talking to me about emotion for the first time, I started listening. And, you know, one of the tools that we've developed is called the Core Emotion Wheel. It looks like an actual wheel and it has, and it lists the 8 core emotions that fire in our brain. And it's such a simple tool, but it's the tool I needed things to be simple.
Yeah.
That was huge.
Yeah. And that I wasn't sure initially. Now I'm 100% convinced. We've researched this so exhaustively that I'll discuss it anywhere, anytime with anybody. But at the time I was hesitant because I'm like, babe, I don't think you actually can opt out of emotion. And she goes, well, I can, I don't do emotion. She was in her late 40s at that point. She's like, you know, I don't have time for emotion. I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure it's just brain chemistry that every human that has a brain has emotion. She's like, not me. And I'm like, and again, I wasn't certain, but I'm just like, I don't think that's real. I don't think that's possible. And again, as I did more and more research, and she would say, well, I don't have time to be sad. And I'd say, babe, I'm not trying to get you to be sad. You already are sad.
Yeah.
Your mom, who's your best friend, who you adore, and she adores you, is dying. That is a sad experience. And she go, I don't have time to be sad. You know, I've got this company to run and I got to get stuff done. And, you know, I would just walk away going, man, that just, something about that doesn't make any sense. And again, as I'm doing the research, and Phyllis was a very difficult case study. She was not a good lab rat. But I just kept coming back to that. And then eventually, well, she went for several days without sleeping. And once that happened, she got pretty desperate because, you know, you can't do that. I mean, the human body's not designed to not sleep for days on end. And when that happened to her, finally, she's like, okay, fine, let's talk about this. And again, she was not pleasant at the beginning because she just wanted to opt out. She wanted to be like, I got stuff to do. I'm going to get stuff done. You know, I'm the productive one and I just need to rock and roll. And she didn't realize that that's not possible. She can't opt out of emotion. Doesn't work.
Like, you can do it until your body's like, no, thank you. And then, and then you're like, as a productive person, you're like, well, now what? And this isn't my identity. And I'm so confused. And your body like makes you almost sometimes. It's been my experience.
Yeah. Wow.
It's wild what the body will do to try to get you to listen sometimes.
Oh, it got her attention. It sure did. Yeah.
So if you start to recognize these emotions, can you label the 8 core emotions you have on your wheel for anybody that's like, what might these be?
Yeah, well, just one step before that, there are 5 neural regions. And again, these are things we now know from brain scanning. We can actually see this. There are 5 neural regions that house the emotions that are the central command center. Emotion occurs throughout the body. But in the limbic system, you have anger, fear, disgust, pleasure, and pain. And that's true for every human on the planet. There are no humans that don't breathe oxygen. Nobody's breathing ice cream. You don't get to choose that. This is just what happens for you, which would be kind of fun, but it's not an option. You have to.
It'd be delicious.
Yeah, see, you got that idea. I was afraid I'm going to be responsible for your death. He's like, she was trying to breathe ice cream. It was weird. Anyway, sorry. So these 5 neural regions just exist. They just are. And that's true for everybody on the planet. We divide the pain region, hurt, sad, and lonely, because they appear so differently on the brain scan, but all 3 of them fire in the pain region of the brain. And then disgust, we divide into guilt and shame, not because they look identical on a brain scan, but they manifest differently. If you watch people's facial expressions, body language, and behavior, it's pretty distinctly different between guilt and shame, even though they appear the same on a brain scan. So we then realize that, oh my gosh, all emotions boil down to these. So there are tremendous, not literally thousands of emotion words, but if someone is terrified, they're just maxed out on fear. But it's the same region as if someone is uncertain. Now, it's a different level. Uncertainty feels very different than terrified, but it's still just in the fear region of the brain. Shame, the maximum of shame would be something like degradation or humiliation. Well, way down here at the other, the lower level of shame is going to be insecurity. You know, I got my hair cut and I feel a little bit insecure because it looks a little goofy because I have so many cowlicks. My great, great, great grandmother actually was a cow, I think. I feel a little bit insecure about my new haircut. Well, I'm not humiliated. I'm not degraded, but it's still just the disgust region of the brain. So as we started realizing that and seeing the picture that, even though humans are incredibly complex, we're actually pretty simple. So now we can narrow this down. Then we start doing the research that if I say to Amber, I feel fear, it tickles the fear region of Amber's brain. And it becomes a shared human experience. And we bond through that. We connect through that because everybody knows what fear is. You know, if I say I'm overwhelmed, well, what does overwhelmed mean? There's not an overwhelmed region of the brain. And so all these other emotions are either levels of or hybrids of the core emotions. When we started narrowing that down, and again, we just started running the research where we get this guy to turn to this girl and say, I felt hurt by what you said. Well, she gets hurt. Everybody knows what hurt is. Everybody knows what pain is. And then they would be able to process through it. Whereas if he came in and said, you know, I can't believe you did that. That was so stupid. That was so mean. You're such a jerk. They never, and we don't say never with human behavior, they never connected. Whereas if he could just say to her, I felt a lot of pain. I felt hurt when you did that. She's actually able to process that through with him. And again, it tickles the pain region of her brain and becomes a shared human experience and they connect.
Well, it sounds like you're kind of beginning to explain how maybe leading with sharing an emotion and emotionally sharing with each other is the pathway, tickling each other's brains, as you're calling it, to connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we encourage people to start every paragraph with the core emotion. And emotion, that's another thing we learned, is that all human behavior is driven by emotion. Everything that we do is connected to an emotion in there somewhere. And if you start recognizing it, and the core emotion wheel is designed to exercise the emotional muscle that has atrophied horribly for most of us. Most of us are oblivious, have no idea even what the core emotions are, much less when we experience them. And now we've exercised so much that I'm actually able to say to Phyllis, I felt hurt by what you said, or I felt shame. You know, you said, thanks for loading the dishwasher, and I felt shame. That's not an indictment of Phyllis. Phyllis is not wrong or bad or evil that she said, thanks for loading the dishwasher. I just felt shame. She doesn't even have to change anything. She might. She has the right to, but she also has the right of refusal. And I have the right of request. I have the right to ask her, babe, could you do that a little bit differently next time? And again, she has the right to go, no, I'm not going to change that. But I'm so valuable to her. She cares enough about me. She's like, yeah, I can shift that. And that's just what we call the dance. And we're just dancing together and vice versa for her to be able to say to me, I feel some fear when you do that, whatever that is. And then I'm able to make shifts because she's so valuable to me. I want to get to partner with her and to dance with her.
You know, one of the things going back to the dishwasher story and just even the question, what's happening for you? It's incredible. That simple sentence, when you use that with all relationships, with your friendships, with your spouse, with your kids, with your coworkers, it's amazing what that brings out of people. And it's like, those are some of the tools that we've developed in and through all the research that Glenn did. And, you know, we've written a book, we've got master classes, we've got, you know, all this activity on our website and all kinds of things, because it's these simple little things that when you shift them in your language, it's incredible how we connect. And, you know, connection, even with strangers, we're like, how can we get more connected? And it's like, well, it is the things that are sometimes overlooked. You know, how can we, even in making space, when he expresses to me that, you know, he's hurt or he's sad, that I don't have to fix anything. And I think often we think we are fixers. We have to be a fixer. You know, you tell me that you're having a bad day and I think I have to fix that instead of just making space for that and just
don't have to fix it.
Right. Yeah. Right. And
sometimes the not fixing it and the making space, that is the solution, the complete solution.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And just the question, what's happening for you, allows the person to actually on their own get it all out and get it said. And then they're almost like they look at you and go, oh, thank you, man. Thank you for this time. And you're just smiling because you're going, wow, I didn't do anything. I didn't say anything. I just asked that one question. And my friend or my spouse was able to get it all said. And then they feel better. And you didn't fix anything. You didn't have to apologize for anything. You just made space for what they're experiencing and what they are able to then on their own say in the situation.
Yeah. And the research shows, and this has been replicated now, so the efficacy of it is pretty solid, that humans don't experience a core emotion for more than 19 seconds if it's not reactivated. And when that research came out, I was just floored by this and then began researching the research. And it makes sense if, and lots of things can reactivate an emotion. But if I say to Phyllis, I felt hurt by what you said, and she goes, what? No, you didn't need to feel hurt by that. I didn't mean anything bad about that. My intention was good. She just reactivated the emotion for me. And now I feel even more hurt. And what we think from a very good heart, I'm not even criticizing people that do this, but what we think is, oh, no. If I explain my intention, then she won't feel hurt by it or whichever direction I was going there. But the opposite is true. Whenever I did, we call that disregarding an experience, disregarding an emotion. And that's one of our protocols. If you disregard someone's experience, you disregard the person. You cannot separate those. And whenever I tell Phyllis she shouldn't have felt hurt because I didn't mean anything hurtful by it, it actually increases the hurt. And now she feels less seen and less heard by me. And that makes it worse, not better. And it's what we call the ooh when she learns, or when I learn just to ooh her, just to be present and safe for her. She's able to process that emotion in 19 seconds, which floors me. I'm just as startled as anybody that this is true. But our tense moments rarely ever last more than 30 seconds, which I would not have thought was possible. I wish I'd known that 30 years ago, because we had, again, 3-day, 3-week conflicts. Literally, where we were just at odds for 3 weeks straight. And our disconnects overlapped, so we never even knew when one ended, when the next one started. And so we literally lived in disconnect for years because it was just continual. And now, which again floors me, that we can process through things in 20 seconds.
This one tool that we're talking about, we always say it's a 4-minute tool, 2 minutes per person, where you're every day doing this with each other. And it does so many incredible things. First of all, I know what's really happening with the other person because they're sharing at the core. But also for myself, it actually gets me to slow down and tune into myself. And for people that are more like me, who just kind of opted out of emotions forever ago, it's like that part of the experience, it's almost like it's not alive anymore, even though it's there, right? And so it's got to be reactivated. And so using this tool for people who don't know how to tune into themselves and go, yeah, what's happening with me, you know? It's like such a simple tool. And to know that it's only a 2-minute per person tool makes it also very doable. And for your listeners, we actually have on our website, so we have a link for them to go to, and they go to connectioncodes.co, Amber, and then
forward slash.
I missed that part. Yeah. Connectioncodes.co. Yeah. Connectioncodes.co/Amber. Then they'll be able to download the core emotion wheel for free and get the directions and get a video of us teaching how to use that tool. And then if they are interested in any of the other master classes, they can put in Amber20 and get a 20% discount on any of
that. That's awesome. Very generous of you guys. Okay, so as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about one of the most common mistakes I see people do when they're trying to process emotion together and they're trying to express their emotion. So I'm going to give you the mistake I see and hopefully you can correct it. Hopefully this works out and put you on the spot. Okay. Let me think of my example. Okay. I feel like I've been unloading the dishwasher more than you lately. Mm. I used to feel, didn't I just process my emotion?
But you talked about the logistic. I feel like I'm unloading the dishwasher more than you. There's no core emotion in there. If I said, well, Amber, I feel like you're a jerk and I feel like, you know, you're just a horrible person. Well, I said feel, but that has nothing to do. Whereas if I'm able to say to you, I felt hurt by what you said earlier. And again, I'm not even accusing you. I just felt pain. I did. And, you know, the connection goes, we always say, well, you can tell Glenn to not feel pain. You can tell him he shouldn't feel pain. Well, he just did. He wasn't trying to feel pain. It's just brain chemistry. And for me to be able to convey that to you, again, I'm not blaming you that I felt hurt. Were you involved? Did you contribute? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe you literally said a good thing like, thanks for unloading the dishwasher. That is not an evil thing. That is not an insulting, awful thing. But I experienced it as an insulting, awful thing. So now in that situation, Phyllis would just say to me, she'd go, babe, I'm feeling some loneliness. And a bit of pain with the whole dishwasher situation. We call it the three phrases. I literally would say to her, oh, what's happening with the pain? What am I missing? And I should just a side note real quickly. The third phrase, I missed it, is just conveying to her that I need her help to be there for her, that I'm just missing what's happening for her. I could say to her, babe, you need to explain yourself better because you did a crappy job explaining it. I can't sell that to her and I can't sell that to anybody on the planet. What I can sell is, hey, could you help me get that? I think I missed part of that as far as what was happening for you. And then she would just tell me, and part of the exercise of the core emotion wheel is to get people to do this in one or two sentences, not six paragraphs. Now, she wouldn't do six paragraphs, but I would. I could do 35 paragraphs. No one can keep up that long. And to this day, Phyllis has to remind me, she'll say, babe, I'm feeling a little bit of loneliness here because I got lost. I've totally missed what you were saying. Could you help me get it? And then I remember, oh yeah, duh, the connection codes. I forgot about those. And then I get it back down to one or two sentences because she can handle that. But the core emotions are all of it. When I get that she feels lonely in this, and then the fourth phrase, the first three phrases go together. Ooh, what's happening? I missed it. And after we process the emotion, the fourth phrase, she says, so I would ask her, so babe, what do you need? And she would say, I need some partnership with the dishwasher because I feel loneliness in it. I feel some pain, which is probably a sad experience. And we literally would dance through that in 20 seconds. And then we'd probably partner together to unload the dishwasher. Part of the problem, just for the record, part of the problem is I deal with a very high level of obsessive compulsive disorder. Unloading the dishwasher for me is about a 45-minute experience. Phyllis can do it in 3.5 minutes. Because for me, unloading the dishwasher means you get a toothbrush and you scrub all the edges, the corners, you rearrange the shelves where you're putting the dishes, probably reline the shelves, which I'm not saying is healthy or functional. I'm just saying that's my tendency. And she gets it that that's a pain experience. And I can now unload the dishwasher in about probably 5 to 8 minutes. I can't break her world record. But I'm able to do it. And I even tell her as I'm unloading, I'm like, oh, it's so painful. I really want to, you know, go through the glasses, throw away the ones that we don't want, won't need. She goes, yeah, I hear you. She follows my energy. She's present with me. And then I'm able to get through this pain experience known as unloading the dishwasher. And we actually partner even deeper. We bond more through that experience. Sorry, that was a long answer.
Yeah. Did we answer your question?
You did. Mine was giving you a mistake I commonly see. And the answer you gave me right away is I didn't label a core emotion. And then you gave all sorts of examples of how you could do that and how it could lead to connection. So yes, question answered.
Good.
There was so much good here. And the overarching message I am taking away from what you're saying is being processing emotion, labeling emotion, and being present with the other's emotion leads you back to connection. Mm-hmm. That's the pathway to find each other again. Yes. So that's what I'm taking away.
Yes.
But if the listeners are listening, and what's a message you're hoping that they take away?
Mm. The big thing is get out of the courtroom, stop fighting over logistics, and learn about emotion. It is our guide. It is our friend. And a lot of people judge emotion. A lot of people are afraid of emotion. A lot of people don't want to do emotion. But shift that thinking. Emotions happen to us, every one of us. So tune in, get curious about yourself, tune into yourself, start there and realize there's not good and bad emotions. There's just the emotions that are firing in your brain, your messengers and your guides.
Yeah. And what I would say to people, and please listen to all these sentences before you jump. Everyone on the planet that's connecting deeply is using the connection codes, not because we say so, not because we wrote a book about it, not because we did a masterclass about it. It's the connection codes. We are coded this way from birth. And this was true long before Phyllis and Glenn were around, long before we discovered the connection codes. We did not invent them. We did not create them. They were pre-existent. We just discovered them. We're the founders. So, and no one on the planet is connecting deeply without using the connection codes. Again, not because we say so, not our book, The Connection Codes, but the connection codes. So you have to learn this to have deep, safe connection. That doesn't mean you can't be in the same room as somebody, but if you're going to have a deep, safe connection, you will have to learn the connection codes. And then we mentioned, you know, sexuality before, and we have a masterclass on sexuality as well. But we build dynamic sexual connection on top of deep emotional connection. And if we don't get the emotional connection first, it's very difficult, and I would suggest impossible to develop. Doesn't mean you can't have sexual activity, but you're not going to have dynamic sexual connection.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. This is all so good. So if people love this just the way I did, you've already given, you said you got your freebie, which is your
Core emotion wheel.
Mm-hmm. There's a course which we're going to link. And then you keep mentioning a book. Is it called Connection Codes?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's on Amazon. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Most people know where Amazon is. If everyone else wanted to follow you, find you, learn more about you, where should they start?
Our website, connectioncodes.co. We're on social media. So you can find us through the Connection Codes, same kind of thing. Yeah.
And also our podcast.
Oh, yeah. We have a podcast too.
Called the Connection Codes.
Is it called Connection Codes?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, we'll certainly link all of those things in the show notes. Yeah. And this was super informative. I love the analogies, the metaphors, the stories, and how you bring to life like these practical, like these, some of the things you got into are high level psychological concepts. Mm. And you broke them down and made them easy be like, oh, this is how I can talk about it with the dishwasher, like a relatable thing that most of us are talking about. If you live with another person and you have a dishwasher.
Right.
Yeah. And that was part of our dream, was to make something very, very simple, doable, implementable. Because like you say, again, I have a master's degree, I have a PhD. If I just throw a whole bunch of fancy, complicated stuff at people and they walk away going, wow, Glenn's amazing. He's so smart and intelligent and educated and funny and kind of cute. We really haven't accomplished much. I feel good about myself, but we haven't really done anything. And our goal was to get it so that people can take this and implement it today, not in 6 months, not in 3 years, literally today. And they will know what to do next. And that's always our objective.
Amazing. Well, I think your objective was achieved.
Oh, good.
Thank you for tuning in to Relationship Psych, the podcast, put on by Ember Relationship Psychology. If you're looking for more free relationship help or advice that comes straight from the couples therapy room, check out the free resources and the blog at www.emberrelationshippsychology.com.